Starbucks. To all the grande, double, no fun, no foam, skinny, extra hot, upside down caramel macchiato drinkers out there, the company may just be the ultimate American success story. For people who just want a cup of coffee black, it might be the epitome of American excess. But the company has gone from opening a store every 4 hours to closing 600 over the last year. Temple University history professor Bryant Simon visited 425 Starbucks in 9 countries to find out why. He says the company was really in the business of selling community, the kind you got in a town square or old-fashioned coffee house. And what we and the company have learned is that community cannot be bought and sold. Simon's new book is Everything But the Coffee, Learning About America from Starbucks. Bryant Simon joins us from Temple University in Philadelphia. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thanks for having me.
And Bryant, we actually had you on the show back in April of 2006 when you were researching the book. And at that time, we interviewed some of the people at our neighborhood Starbucks here. So let's actually go back and listen to some of that tape.
I get dressed up before I come to Starbucks just because you have to fit the persona of, like, going with the flow, trendy, the music they keep, like jazz, fusion, blues, everything. It's all about newness, and I think the best way to put it is it's harder not to go to Starbucks than it is to go.
This is sounding weird, but I like the smell that leaves my clothes. And I really do. Like, if they made, like, a Starbucks perfume, I'd probably buy it.
Okay, so not entirely sure if that Starbucks perfume idea really took off, but maybe that's exactly the kind of novel thinking the company is looking for now, because this past week we went back to that very same Starbucks and asked people what they thought of the company now, and here's what they had to say.
I don't come here to look cool.
I think it could be because it's so commercialized now, and because it is so big, it's not really as cool or unique as it might have been, you know, years ago.
Wow, those are great quotes. Those sort of bookend my book. In many ways, what I argue is that the fundamental thing that Starbucks sold, as it taught us to buy $4 cups of coffee, is it sold a way for us to present ourselves for others to see. And with that cup in our hand in 2006 and before, we looked cool, we looked sophisticated. And we also looked like we had people with $4 to waste on coffee. And you can see in 3 short years, people aren't seeing the same cultural values. And they're going increasingly for utility, a place to sit, or just the quickest caffeine fix.
It is a pretty remarkable change because, as you write in your book, in Starbucks' early years, the median income of a Starbucks frequenter was $81,000. And that changed as the company grew and went down to $56,000. But I wonder, back in those early days, I mean, if we could just rewind a bit and talk about sort of where Starbucks and those $81,000 earning customers came from. I mean, it was a Seattle company, virtually unheard of before the 1990s. And how did it go from that to being this sort of ubiquitous cultural icon?
Starbucks put itself in the way of cultural leaders, the kinds of people that others wanted to emulate, highly educated, successful in their jobs, moderately hip. And it got those people as its early adapters. And once they had them on board, others who wanted to emulate them would buy the brand, hoping that they too would seem like these moderately hip, successful, sophisticated people. And that's the perfect model for a product that trades on culture.
The company went from some 1,800 stores in 1998 to 16,000, I believe, by 2008. But there's kind of a darker side to that, that you say it may have actually undermined the company by growing so fast.
At one point, Starbucks was opening a store every 4 hours somewhere around the world. But what happened is the brand in some ways consumed itself. It sold things that we wanted, and it packaged them and marketed them. And what happened was it either didn't fulfill those desires or a competitor came along and did a better job of it.
So these desires, now this is really kind of the heart of your book, that one of the primary desires that Starbucks was so successful at selling was this desire for a community space.
What Starbucks identified was a kind of very important shift and a very important need in American society. Throughout the post-war period, I mean post-World War II, Americans sort of moved to the suburbs, they became locked in their cars. For fear, they increasingly live behind gated communities. But at the same time, while they were sort of securing themselves, they began to feel as though they were missing something, a kind of community that we often associate with older city neighborhoods. And Starbucks understood that desire, and from the very beginning, they suggested that their stores, like the old coffee houses, were something called third places, a place between work and home where people would gather. Starbucks aggressively marketed itself as the place the community would be constructed, maintained, and renewed.
Okay, and how exactly did the company do that? How did it say, we are that third place?
Well, it did that through what a company with 16,000 stores can do, insistence. And also a CEO that at one point was on MSNBC, I think, and the little ticker below it said Rockstar CEO.
This is Howard Schultz you're speaking
about. Yeah, and they said over and over again, we're a third place, we're a third place. They put it in their marketing information, the art on the walls, the jazz music in the background, the Italian-esque sounding names, all of that, the quotes on the cups, were to conjure up the feeling of the coffee house and the notion of community. And perhaps most fundamentally, the company coached the people who worked there, the baristas, to create a connection with their customers.
Well, I've got to ask you, what's wrong with that, though? I mean, they're providing a space where people can gather. They're training their staff to be friendly and actually, you know, maybe want to be people you speak with. They're creating an environment that's warm and welcoming that doesn't, when you look at it that way, it's not necessarily so nefarious. It is providing a need where if these spaces don't actually exist elsewhere in our communities.
I don't disagree that Starbucks created something that in many places we didn't have a place to go. But what you got was not a kind of replica of the old coffee house. The old coffee houses were often called penny universities. They were priced so that anyone can come. So obviously you can see a distinction between Starbucks there. Literally, people would sit on benches right next to each other. You didn't get your own private table. And you were encouraged to talk. And any talk was possible in those places. And that's not really what happens at Starbucks. The quotes on the cups, which were also supposed to stimulate discussion, are so banal that no one could disagree with them. And then when one person did disagree with one, I mean, there's been a couple cases, but there's a famous case at Baylor University where the quote was from a novelist who suggested maybe he regretted part of his life he spent in the closet. Starbucks pulled the cups. Community needs to have diversity of people in it. Community needs to have someone behind the counter whose investment is in community, not in a kind of performance.
So part of what you're saying is that there's still always this overriding sense that this is actually a commodity we're purchasing, not buying into a true sense of community.
Yeah, exactly. And I think one other point that I think is important is I'm not just blaming Starbucks for everything that's wrong here. In a sense, I blame us, and I even blame myself. There's a part in that section that you talked about where I try and talk to people, and I'm not very good at it. And part of what I think has happened is we've made this move in this country to more closed quarters, to more suburban quarters, to being in cars more. We've lost our own skills to connect with people we don't know.
But if that's the issue, why are you writing a book criticizing Starbucks?
I think that what can be revealed in the company's success is some of the deeper needs and desires of Americans, but also why they don't go fulfilled. And that's because brands increasingly occupy those spaces that were occupied by government and community, and they promise to fulfill them. And Starbucks seems to me emblematic of that. So I don't want to pretend that there aren't parts of the book that aren't critical of Starbucks, but my aim was not to do a kind of Michael Moore-style attack on the company.
Isn't possibly another way of seeing this is that the story of Starbucks is particularly American. I mean, here's a company that recognized a need, as you say, the lack of civic spaces, and they filled that need through a really, really simple device, you know, making a cup of coffee for you. And hey, they made a profit at the same time. You know, to turn your thesis on its head a bit, I mean, maybe this is a story to be celebrated.
I think there is a way to celebrate the story if what we're celebrating is profitability. What doesn't resolve from it is the fulfillment of that fundamental need for connection. If Starbucks tells us again and again with the power of its marketing, or any corporation for that matter, that this is what community is, it makes it harder to find truer versions of it someplace else.
And actually, you mention in the book that you know, in casually thinking about this, it may be really easy to think that, hey, you know, all of we consumers out there are just this mindless mass of dupes who are being controlled by a very intelligent and savvy corporation. But in the end, people really aren't dupes, and they started turning away from the company, like you said. You know, starting in 2006, we see the – or 2007, I should say, we start seeing the slow – not decline, but the polish comes off this company.
Both the polish comes off the company and its mass audience starts to lose fragments as other purveyors of coffee and products begin to offer something more authentic or more true to what they initially wanted. And one of the obvious ones is the kind of emergence of third wave and independent coffee places.
What you're describing was really ringing alarm bells over there in Seattle. I mean, CEO Howard Schultz began to really worry about this sort of decline of customers at his stores, and he responded by doing some remarkable things. I mean, shutting 7,000 stores for 3 hours to train so-called baristas to get back into the groove of how to make coffee. And that, you know, depending on your perspective, may or may not have worked, but eventually Starbucks closed some 600 stores for good last year. So this overreach that you're talking about has really come back to haunt the company.
They've been very aggressive in the last year, cutting costs and streamlining production, which has helped the profit margin, but I'm not sure that it'll help them reclaim that cultural capital that you heard in that first clip you played from 2006, where the one guy is just effusive in what Starbucks represents for him.
So what do you think actually would help reclaim that cultural capital, or even, you know, should it be for a company like Starbucks? Is that what they should be aiming for?
Well, I think that's going to be really hard to do. Reclaiming that kind of space when you're the maker of trends is not an easy thing to do once you've lost it. That said, Starbucks has a lot of assets in its favor, not the least of which are some amazing real estate locations and a lot of them. In some ways, I think that Starbucks needs to get back to the coffee, and that's what Schultz himself said. As much of the other cultural trappings have been shorn away from the company, what's left is coffee. I mean, if I were Starbucks, I would make sure I had every location in every airport. I'd have every location on every freeway. And I would be there in the places where people can't make other choices about coffee.
Well, finding these new ways and new channels to grow into seems to be exactly what the company's doing. I mean, they just recently released that new instant coffee, which...
Yeah, I don't know if that's, like, the best idea, because I tasted it today for the first time.
Did you like it?
Yeah, it's not bad at all. The thing is, instant coffee is still instant coffee, and I don't think that having really good instant coffee can enhance your coffee-ness as a company.
Well, reclaiming that sort of cultural cachet, it seems like that is exactly what Starbucks is trying to do. I mean, we read in Fortune magazine that Starbucks has begun to open so-called stealth stores. I mean, they're Starbucks-owned stores minus the Starbucks name, and they're meant to mimic those exact small, independent, sort of high-quality coffee shops that you were talking about. I mean, is this the kind of thing that you think is going to help the company and help us also find those civic spaces that we still seem to be looking for?
I don't know. I think opening coffee shops without your name on it is an admission of defeat to a certain extent. Moreover, it's part of a really interesting dynamic that's going on right now. Brands across the world have mushroomed and oozed and grown so far and so wide, they've created a pushback. And that pushback is centered on an increasing desire for the local, an increasing desire for the more natural. And you can see this in the proliferation of farmers markets and in the proliferation of kind of independent coffee shops. That's where the cultural cachet is now. And I don't know that it can reclaim that by pretending it isn't a Starbucks. But in some ways, there are some silver linings to this story, and I end the book talking about them. If you think about some of the values that Starbucks sells, they're the values or the basis, possibly, for a more just and sane and, I think, cooperative social order. And one of the things that people wanted from Starbucks was a sense of community. Another thing they wanted was greener products and greener policies from companies. And finally, in the sourcing of the coffee itself, customers expressed a desire for the United States and for the larger industrial powers to leave less of a footprint around the world. These are all some pretty positive ideas that people went to Starbucks to get. They didn't always get them, but I think that there's something to build on there.
So in that sense, when you say Starbucks is us or Starbucks is a reflection of us, maybe part of the reflection is a little better than we thought.
Absolutely. I mean, it embodies some of what's best in us and also some of maybe our laziness of trying to get the things that we value the most with nothing more than purchasing a cup of coffee.
Bryant Simon is the author of Everything But the Coffee, Learning About America from Starbucks. Bryant Simon, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.